In a city like Baltimore, where the drug war rages on, shootings and homicides are an almost daily occurrence, and the heaviest police presence can be found in poor Black communities, there are a lot of Keith Davis Jr.'s. By that I mean there are many 20-something Black men who may have never held a gun in their life, but legally, they never will, thanks to a combination of circumstance, youthful decision-making, aggressive stats-driven policing, and deceptively sweet plea deals. For most of his life, Keith's father, also named Keith, was in and out of the picture, so his mom, Tanette, was his primary parent. They lived in Catonsville in Baltimore County, and eventually Tanette married Keith's stepfather, Tony. Tanette had Keith when she was a teenager, and while she may have done her best was not always good for Keith. As he got older, their relationship became more difficult, even more so after Tony was sentenced to federal prison. Keith was just 12 years old when he was kicked out of his house for the very first time. At age 16, he was on his own for good. He moved to Park Heights in the northwest part of the city, sometimes crashing with his dad's ex-girlfriend, Rhea, and her son, Thule, at their house on West Garrison Avenue. When Keith was shot by Baltimore police on June 7, 2015, and FIT detectives were trying to notify his next of kin, Rhea's old house on West Garrison was their first stop. But now it's a vacant. Thule is 2 years younger than Keith, and they're not related by blood, but they're brothers in the ways that count. Kelly Davis, Keith's wife, actually knew Thule first and crushed on him a little. When her daughter Peyton got a new bike last year, Thule was the one she trusted to come over and put it together, since Keith couldn't. Like many young Black men in Baltimore, Keith caught the attention of police while he was still, to use their parlance, a juvenile. As of June 2015, he'd been arrested about a dozen times, mostly on drug charges, and about half the cases had been dropped. What remains is a disturbing reflection of the ease with which Baltimore police, prosecutors, and judges throw young Black men into the prison system as soon as they come of age, knowing full well that they won't come home the better for it. Keith is still paying mightily for his first adult conviction in February 2010. He and a co-defendant, also named Keith, were arrested on 7 drug charges, including distribution, unlawful possession, and possession with intent to manufacture and distribute. He'd been arrested 3 other times in as many months, but for simple possession, and those charges had been dropped immediately. But these charges were more serious. Several came with a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison. Who can blame Keith for taking the deal offered by prosecutors, pleading guilty to just 1 count of distribution in exchange for a 7-year suspended sentence plus 3 years probation? Who can blame any of the many, many, many other defendants who take similar deals all the time? On its face, it seems like a get-out-of-jail-free card, until another conviction, because no matter how minor the offense, it will trigger a probation violation, and suddenly prosecutors aren't interested in negotiating. In Keith's case, a simple marijuana possession charge over Memorial Day weekend in 2011 resulted in a 4-year prison sentence. That deal in his very first criminal case wasn't done biting him in the ass either, though he likely didn't realize it at the time and couldn't have anticipated the long-term impact. By pleading guilty to the drug distribution charge, Keith Davis Jr. had been convicted of a disqualifying crime. At 19 years old, he was a prohibited person.
Welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 5 of The State versus Keith Davis Jr. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the book Adnan Story. Join me as we continue to follow the story of Keith Davis Jr. as told by our investigator and reporter, Amelia McDonald Perry. I love spooky stories, and if you're like me, you're going to love Season 2 of Family Ghosts, a podcast that takes a closer look at the legendary tales that shape our family histories. Guess what? Pretty much every house is haunted. And in each episode of Family Ghosts, we investigate the true story behind a mysterious figure whose legend has followed a family for generations. Grandmothers who were secretly jewel smugglers, uncles who led double lives, siblings who vanished without a trace. These specters cast shadows over our lives in ways that might not be immediately obvious, but we're all formed in part by our familial collections of secrets, intrigues, and myths. These are our family ghosts. And by engaging with each other's legends, maybe we can see each other's realities more clearly. On Family Ghosts, the families are real, the ghosts are metaphorical. It's still kind of spooky. And the truth is always relative. So check out the new season of Family Ghosts. New episodes come out every Wednesday with stories like the secrets revealed by a long-lost stack of love letters and a missing container of Chinese food that has haunted a family for 25 years. Family Ghosts has everybody's attention. It's getting great reviews. Like the Irish Times, it says, it feels like listening to an especially fascinating acquaintance tell a long story in a pub through the lens of a 1990s American high school comedy. And App Therapy, which says, each episode is not only utterly absorbing, like edge of your seat, nail-biting good, but like all good art, it touches on universal feelings and themes. Human resilience, trust, loyalty, betrayal, how well any of us can ever know each other. So check out the new season and don't forget to subscribe to Family Ghosts wherever you get your podcasts.
On January 8th, Assistant State's Attorney Lizette Ringgold Kirksey requested that Keith Davis Jr.'s trial be postponed for a third time because he was scheduled to be arraigned on five new prohibitive gun charges that she had been, quote, advised to add back in early December. A brief postponement would allow the cases to be consolidated and ready for trial as of January 19th, 2016. Quote, "We looked and saw he was a prohibited person," she explained, as if it were a new revelation. It shouldn't have been. The state's own discovery files included Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services records printed on June 7, 2015, which indicated on the very first page that Keith was not allowed to possess a regulated firearm. That's because Keith has been convicted of a so-called disqualifying crime, which in Maryland includes a felony, a crime of violence, or any violation classified as a misdemeanor in the state that carries a statutory penalty of more than 2 years. Keith's attorney, Latoya Frances Williams, said the state was being tactical to get another postponement. She also noted that one of the state's own witnesses was apparently in Puerto Rico, referring to Sergeant Alfredo Santiago, one of the four Baltimore police officers who shot Keith Davis Jr. on June 7, 2015. Ringgold Kirksey argued that Williams had incorrect information. On February 1st, the state requested its fourth and what would be its final trial postponement, this time because of a discovery issue, namely the state's issue with turning over discovery materials to the defense in a timely manner. In court that day, Ringgold Kirksey handed over the taped statements of officers Israel Lopez, Lane Eskins, and Catherine Philippou. Nearly 7 months after they shot dozens of rounds at Keith Davis Jr. inside a dark auto repair garage, the officers were finally compelled to speak with Internal Affairs. Lopez was interviewed on January 18th, while Eskins and Philippou gave statements on January 19th, the same day that Ringgold Kirksey had suggested for the postponement the last time around. One officer's statement was still outstanding, though. Miss Williams was right. Sergeant Santiago was still in Puerto Rico when the officers gave their statements in January. The state's fourth postponement was the last one they'd need to complete their quartet. On February 2nd, Santiago finally sat down with Internal Affairs to give his account of the shooting on Eleonora Avenue that Sunday morning. It's not exactly clear how long Santiago was out of the country, but he was unavailable as of mid-November 2015, when Keith's trial was postponed for a second time. And Marilyn Mosby issued declination letters to all four of the shooting cops. It's hard not to wonder if there were concerns that Santiago might not return. How would that have impacted the state's case against Keith? Not to mention the perception of the police shooting, the other involved officers, and Mosby's decision to absolve any of them of wrongdoing. Why did Santiago leave? And what made him finally come back? In late December 2015, following several trial postponements by the state, Keith's defense attorney, LaToya Francis Williams, filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus for the purpose of determining admission to bail. Getting Keith adequate medical care was the primary goal, as months of pretrial detention immediately following his release from the hospital had taken a serious toll on his health. The gunshot to his face severely fractured his jawbone, requiring major surgery, and the incisions to his cheek and neck had become seriously infected. The damage to his sinus cavity hindered his breathing and caused painful nerve damage, not to mention the bullet lodged in his neck, which should have been removed months earlier. Keith was granted a bail hearing in early February 2016, just a few days after his trial was postponed for a fourth time, and Williams came prepared to use the state's own evidence to dispute the most serious charges. Keith had not been identified by Charles Holden, the victim of the attempted armed robbery, and there was no evidence to support the charge of discharging a firearm. The Hammerly Trailside 22 that the police claimed Keith possessed and repeatedly pointed in their direction, all of the ballistics evidence at the scene came from the officers' guns, and the gun wasn't loaded. In light of those facts, Williams argued, Keith should be granted bail. Judge Christopher Panos denied the petition. Until the case went to trial and that evidence was assessed by a jury, the statement of charges were the facts of the case. The decision was a major disappointment, but the hearing resulted in a small but significant victory. The bullet protruding from Keith's neck was grotesquely swollen, and on his own accord, Judge Panos expressed serious concern about Keith's health. Since prosecutors wanted him held without bail, it was now their responsibility to ensure that he received immediate medical attention. Panos issued a court order requiring the state's attorney's office to arrange for Keith to be seen by his surgeon, Dr. Cockamese, within 5 days. The state's attorney's office ignored the court order. Then, on February 19th, the first day of Keith's scheduled trial, just before jury selection, prosecutor Ringgold Kirksey remembered, almost as an afterthought, that she had one bit of unfinished business to take care of.
There's one count that the state doesn't need all cross.
Okay.
Oh, please, do tell, counsel.
Your Honor, in indictment 11520-8019, the state would enter a null cross for the illegal discharge of a firearm count, which I believe is count 15.
Okay. All right. That has been an all rust. You can advise the client.
Okay.
Right, exactly. This
moment stuck out as particularly appalling to Anya Parampil, a journalist from RT America, who was one of the first reporters to cover Keith's case from a critical perspective.
So they were forced to drop their discharge of a firearm charge, and that immediately also suggests that they were just fishing for charges they could throw at him, if they would actually accuse him of something they later had to back away from because they didn't even have evidence. They've charged him with firing a weapon which had never been discharged.
How did the grand jury become convinced to include that discharging of a firearm charge? Like, what were they told that allowed them to bring that charge?
Right. It raises serious questions about what the state attorney's office told them. And how that can stand as acceptable is just beyond me. If that's the level of just disregard they can have for law or trying to find any what's really happened here and find the truth, then I don't see how we can trust the state attorney's office on anything.
Peggy Amaker Murphy is a longtime member of Team Keith and has attended every trial. She became interested in the case while doing court support for arrestees following the uprising. She was a little nervous when she learned Judge Barry Williams would preside over Keith's robbery trial.
So the first trial, the biggest thing was we were getting Judge Williams right after he had had the Freddie Gray officers.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really kind of on the forefront lines. Going into it, we were more focused on the judge. And the judge also knew many people who are activists in Baltimore from the Freddie Gray police trials.
Right.
So there was, kind of going in, there was more of a concern for the judge, which ended up being really non-existent.
Kelly was a defense witness, so she wasn't allowed to be inside the courtroom during the trial. She sat right outside, though. and she had some company.
Kelly was not allowed to be in the courtroom, and that courtroom had a big vestibule outside of it. So there's that big area that has benches around it.
Mm-hmm.
So for all the way up through till all the police officers went, Kelly was sitting on those benches with the police officers. And there was shenanigans going on with that. They know the line. They didn't cross the actual line. But they were, how close can we sit to Kelly and joke about how we went hunting with our guns this last weekend? Or we went to the target range. Or can we talk about where we went on vacation and all that we had to drink on vacation? I mean, it was those type of things.
Right.
That was going on. Mm-hmm. Why we were all in the courtroom and Kelly was out there by herself. At that point, Kelly didn't know any of us well enough. And the other person who was out there, who they didn't know who it was, is Keith's sister. So Kiki was out there the whole time. I think at that point, Kelly left the courthouse, and when she came back, she talked to a sheriff officer. She went downstairs and talked to a sheriff officer who called upstairs to the judge.
Wow.
And they had a bailiff sit with her for the rest of the trial.
The state's first witness was the victim of the armed robbery, hack driver Charles Holden. Mr. Holden's statement on the day of the incident was pretty clear and consistent. A light-skinned black guy with plaits in his hair hopped in the passenger seat of his car at West Belvedere and Park Heights, demanded a ride, and when Mr. Holden told him he had no gas, the man pulled a shiny silver gun out of his bag and said, "Unk, drive." Here he is describing the gun on the witness stand.
Do you recall being asked what this gun looked like?
Yes.
And you described the gun as silver?
Silver, and like I said, it was an automatic, also a revolver, has like a turntable on it, and it had no turntable on it. It was like a automatic, you could put a click up in there. And I told him the gun was gray or silver or chrome. It was like a light gray or something.
Do you remember telling the interviewer that the gun was all silver, all shiny? You remember saying that?
Yeah, but it was, what I seen.
And you remember saying it was a brand new gun?
I never said it was old or brand new. I don't know a brand new gun from an old gun like that, as you asked me that. I don't know whether a gun new or not me. I told you what color it was. It was silver gray.
It was silver and gray, or was it silver?
I'll show you something that looked just like, I was darker than that. That silver there, a little bit, just a little bit darker. It's like, it's, you can see.
You remember specifically being asked whether this gun had a multicolor handle?
Don't ask me nothing like that.
Would you like me to refresh your memory?
Did you? Good. I don't remember about that. What kind of multicolor it had, nothing like that. I don't ask no question like that. If you can refresh it, let's do it.
Mr. Holden's memory had to be refreshed quite a bit by the defense. His overall account of the incident was the same, but some of the details had changed. He also seemed to find courtroom procedures a little frustrating.
During the hack driver's testimony, it got so surreal at that point that by the time the police officers came up, we were already like, this is just crazy and nothing they can say can shock us. He was the first witness. So that was their star witness that they were opening with, and it went sideways so fast. I mean, it was within like 15, 20 minutes. We're mm-hmm. all, and the judge was having problems holding it together.
Really?
So hold on, I'm approaching Mr. Mark for ID purposes at this time, the state's exhibit number one. Can you take a look at this? Mm-hmm. Can you flip through the pages, please?
That's my handwriting.
You can just flip through the pages. Sir, flipping through the pages, does this document look familiar to you?
Yes.
Okay. And
yes, I guess it did.
And do you recall being down at the station? You just referred to the police officer showing you some photos.
Yes, they showed me some photos.
Are these the photos that they showed you on that day?
Yeah, it looked like them the one, but I couldn't make a positive identification of it.
Right. When you're showing the photos, But is this a fair and accurate representation of the photos that were actually shown to you?
Yeah.
State removed this meant to evidence, state exhibit number one.
Any objection?
No objection.
So in.
So Mr. Holden, upon looking at these photos at the station, you just said you weren't able to pick someone out.
I got bad eyes.
Do you recall, do you recall why you weren't able to pick someone out at the time?
Because I couldn't really, by looking at the picture, I couldn't really make a positive identification. Okay. I didn't want to pick nobody wrong. I wouldn't want to do that. No, I didn't see no tattoos or nothing.
So you didn't see any tattoos?
I don't remember that from dead to now.
And you were looking at the person's hands and arms?
I was watching that gun.
Was the gun in their hand?
The gun was in his hand.
The gun was in his hand?
Yeah.
Do you remember what hand the gun was in?
In his right hand.
So were you looking at his right hand?
Yes.
And you're saying that you didn't see any tattoos on his right hand?
No, no.
Did you see any tattoos on his right arm?
No, 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 no.
He's doing double takes at Holden?
Really?
Did you really just say that kind of thing? And the rest of the trial, he pulled it together and kept a stony face. You couldn't read his reactions at all. But with Holden, he was just like, wait, what? Wait, what did you just say? And there was the one point where Holden turned to the judge and said, when do I get to ask questions?
You mean, what you mean, I want to call him? I told him that the gun was like gray or like a chrome style. That's what I told him.
You told him that the gun was all one color?
It was one color. I ain't saying it had no 10 colors. One color is all I seen. When we came along, excuse me, sir.
No, sir.
I want to let her know something.
No, that's not how it works. She has to ask you questions.
Oh, I got to. Let me ask her just one.
No. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not fear.
Oh, my God. Pure comedy.
And the judge... I mean, his face at that point, he is trying hard not to break out in laughter. He is doing his best to give respect to this older gentleman. And it is taking every bit in his to pull his face together.
When you came here today and you got on the witness stand, you asked the state a question. Isn't that right?
Say it again.
When you just came in here this afternoon and you sat down, you asked Madam State a question, didn't you?
That's a question.
You asked her, is the guy here? Is the guy in here? Didn't you just ask her that?
Yes, I asked her that.
Okay, and what guy are you talking about?
My eyes bad. It looked like the one beside you.
Okay. And so you told him that he had good sized hair, right?
Yeah.
And it was plaid. You didn't say his hair was low cut. You didn't say that, did you?
No.
You didn't say he was bald headed, did you?
No.
You didn't say he had a low fade or anything like that, right?
No.
And just to be clear, plaited is kind of like twining the hair, right?
Yes.
Okay. Do you also recall giving a description of this person's beard?
His beard was long.
You said
shadow.
His beard was long.
Yes,
and he
shadow.
Gave this kind of motion, right?
Yes, shadow.
And so this is... describing that it's coming from the sideburns all the way down to the chin?
From the half of his face down to his chin.
So he had hair all on his face down to his chin?
Yeah, not long hair.
Not long hair, right?
Right.
So I have no hair, okay?
Right.
But you're saying this is more than what I have, isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. And then you also remember describing the person as being a little light skin, right?
Yes.
Not too light though.
Yes.
Right? He was about my complexion?
No, he was lighter than you.
He was lighter than me?
Yes.
But he wasn't light skinned.
Lighter than you? I don't know what you're going to call that after that.
Well, it's your statement. Right? You said he was not real light. Isn't that what you said?
I told the police he was light skinned guy. I didn't say he wasn't. He wasn't hot yellow, but I said he was light.
Do you remember describing this person and his clothing that he had on?
I can't call that after all this time. You should have asked me that earlier. I forgot. I had told the police what he had on. I thought I did.
And then when you told them at that time what he had on, were you being truthful at that time?
Yes. I'm telling them what I seen, what I can remember. I told them.
Okay. And you gave your statement about 3 hours after this incident happened to you?
No.
Well, how long after?
I said it was an hour.
About an hour?
Yeah.
So an hour after this incident, you described the person's clothing. Do you remember saying that the person had on shorts?
He had on long pants. He had no shorts on.
Do you remember describing that he had on blue or black shorts?
He didn't have no shorts on. He had long pants.
Your Honor, may I approach the witness?
I think that's what I told him. That man 8 months ago. I can't really remember.
Okay, so
that's whatever I told him, that's what happened then.
So whatever you told them back in June, that's what it was.
That's what it was, yeah.
Okay. So today you're having a little difficulty remembering. But back in June, what you said is what it was.
Right, because it was closer to the time what it happened at the time. This is 8 months, 9 months ago from today.
Remember. After the shooting on Eleonora Avenue, Officer Lane Eskins left the scene and went to go find Charles Holden, escorting him back to the Northwestern District Station.
But in the interview, for instance, Charles Holden, the cab driver who was robbed, was sure and was going by their direction, said, oh yeah, the guy we got is the guy who held me up, even though his description of him didn't fit. And he later testified, they'd assured him that they had gotten the guy.
The police told me it was shooting. Police told me that.
What police officer told you that?
The police that was arrested did a report on St. Charles and Belvedere.
So the police officer that was doing that accident report, that officer?
Yeah, that officer.
And where were you when the police told you that they were shooting?
When police told me it was shooting, I was downtown in the police district.
Was it on Reisterstown Road?
No, not on the Reisterstown Road. The one on Federal Street, Fayette.
So the police officer,
Fayette,
on the day in question, came to you at police headquarters and told you that they were shooting?
I asked him, did he get the guy? That's how I went on. And he told me, yes, he think he shot the guy in the face. I said, officer, you ain't a good shot. You should have killed him.
And so, when you asked this police officer, did you get the guy? You were talking about the guy in your car, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the police officer told you, yeah, I shot him. Isn't that right?
He told me he got the guy.
So you were led to believe that the person that the officer shot was the person in your car, right?
Yes.
And you believe that because the police officer told you that, right?
Yes, the police have no reason to lie to me.
Police have no reason to lie to you?
No.
Okay. And they told you this before you gave your taped interview, isn't that right?
It was after the taped interview.
What time was your interview?
It was in that morning. They let me leave to about 2 o'clock or something like that.
So you believe after you gave a taped interview and described this assailant that a police officer, a Baltimore City police officer, came to you and told you the person that was shot was the person in your car. Isn't that right?
He told me they got the person. Okay. That's what he told me they got.
And you did not second guess it, did you?
Second guess it for what?
Charles Holden may have walked out of that courtroom more confused than when he walked in. Here's Brandon Weigle, who reported on the trials for the City Paper and now works for Baltimore Fishbowl.
I mean, all over the place is a good way to put it. I think I described it as bumbling in print, which is maybe not nice, but...
Mr. Holden, defense counsel asked you at one point in time if the defendant sitting in the courtroom was the person that was in your car. Can you recall that?
And then the most dramatic moment in the court was when he said that he'd had glaucoma and he couldn't see that well.
Objection.
I couldn't see him from here. If I go closer, I can tell you that's him or not, if I can get closer. My eye just had an operation about
two or three months ago, and I got glaucoma, so I ain't made to see nothing. You blurry from here.
Your Honor, may we approach?
You may.
Mr. Holt, I'm going to ask you to come from the witness stand.
But I remember him clearly, like, standing up because he couldn't see very well.
You take a good look at the defendant and see if you recognize him.
And he walked up really, really close, right directly into Davis's face and said,
"To my recollection, that don't look like it went to me."
Megan Kenny, another member of Team Keith, remembers that moment like it was yesterday.
"That's not the guy who had a gun to my ribs robbing me. That's not him."
It's amazing. I can imagine the gasp in the courtroom.
Oh, it was something else. Mm-hmm. It was... I don't know if my heart had ever felt that movement of like, wait, what? Yeah. And then thinking that it's all over now and it's done and, here we are years later.
Yeah.
The least surprised person in the courtroom might have been Keith Davis Jr.
When Holden says, "No, that doesn't look like him," I was like, what were you thinking? He was like, "I was thinking that he been said that it wasn't fucking me and nobody listened."
Support for this show is brought to you by the new Audible original, Heads Will Roll, from Saturday Night Live's Kate McKinnon and co-creator Emily Lynn. Enter the Night Realm, where evil Queen Mortana and her ditzy raven sidekick must put down a peasant rebellion and save the throne. While their friendship survives sensitive generals, chatty sex slaves, whiny behemoths, princes with bird fetishes, and the very notion of democracy. This audio satire also features the wicked talents of Meryl Streep, Tim Gunn, Peter Dinklage, Queer Eye's Fab Five, A.D. Bryant, and so many more. It's a scripted audio comedy that's like TV for your ears. And you can listen for free with a 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/undisclosedheads or text the SMS code undisclosedheads to 500-500. This content is not for kids. It's for mature audiences only. The audio comedy features sexual content, adult language and themes, and violence against peasants and hobgoblins alike. Discretion is advised. And again, you can listen for free with a 30-day trial by going to audible.com/undisclosedheads or text the SMS code UNDISCLOSEDHEADS to 500-500.
The first one was sounding so confident and made it all sound so logical, but then each additional one, it fell apart more and more and more. The testimony was all over the place for the four of them. There's definite things where they got the story straight, like they worked on certain parts of the story, but all you had to do was scratch the surface and it went off the rails. During one of the officers' testimonies, one of the jurors started hitting himself in the head with the little notepad they give him. How stupid are these cops?
The first shooting officer to testify was Lane Eskins, who was working as the Northwest District's wagon man on June 7th, 2015. He's by far the most polished of the involved officers, especially on the witness stand. Comfortable, confident, cocky. Here's former Baltimore Police Internal Affairs Detective Larry Smith Jr.
From all the court testimony I've listened to and from hearing the internal affairs interviews, Eskins is almost like the narrator of the entire event. They interviewed everyone involved, but Eskins is the one who delivers the most detailed account of the incident from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And as you listen to it in its various incarnations, like in internal affairs interviews and the various court testimony, people disappear. Like Philippou may as well not even have been on the planet in some of the testimony. Santiago and Philippou are counted on as little as possible to recall specific details or to really kind of give like the meat of the incident.
All four shooting officers, plus two of the witnessing officers, Diana Brown and Thomas Kirby Jr., testified at the attempted armed robbery trial. Rather than addressing their testimonies one at a time, it's far more interesting to hear them in relation to each other, don't you think? So let's go back to the beginning and do this chronologically. When hack driver Charles Holden stopped his car in the left-hand lane at the scene of the car wreck near St. Charles Avenue, officers Philippou and Eskins were standing in the median about a car length between them, filling out accident reports.
So then he goes into the whole ordeal where he's trying to stop the driver from leaving, opening the door, whatever. And then the guy's like, he says, the bus hit me.
The individual in the car, I could see inside the car, the driver's window was down. It was a small car. I could see that there was two people in the car. The driver said to me, leaned out the window and pointed behind him and said, that bus just hit me. He was very adamant about that. And he said it again, that bus just hit me. I said, okay, all right, just, you know, give us a second. He started to get out of the vehicle. As he was getting out of the vehicle, he looked at me with a, just had a strange look on his face. I wasn't quite sure what was going on, so I put my hand up to hold onto the door so I wouldn't get hit with the door. He pushed the door open and got out. He started to circle around behind me. At that point in time, I wasn't sure what his intentions were, so I grabbed a hold of him. I grabbed a hold of his chest area by his clothing. As he circled around behind me, he said, he started pointing into the car. He said, that guy's got a gun. That guy's got a gun. I let go of him and spun around and looked inside the vehicle. And at that point in time, I saw the passenger of the vehicle exiting the vehicle with a gun.
Eskins is like, he says a bus hit him.
Yeah.
I mean, and the Eskins is trying to keep him inside the car, apparently.
Yeah, when she never even mentions the bus.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. Like, her version is totally different.
Do you recall which lane that car pulled into?
The car pulled up in the lane closest to the median, the only free flow of traffic.
And when it came to a stop, did it stop in that lane?
Yes.
So the other vehicles on the road, what happened to those other vehicles?
They all had to stop because I looked up and I was a little bit agitated at the fact because we only have one lane of free flowing traffic and this car just stopped out of nowhere. And I was going to say something, but it's so fast that driver just hopped out, said he's got a gun, and that's when I looked and the whole foot chase basically ensued.
So it's your testimony that the passenger simply sat in the car?
The passenger was still sitting in the car when the driver ran out with his hands up, saying he's got a gun, ran towards the 7-Eleven, and as soon as I finished looking, I looked, as soon as he said he's got a gun, I looked straight into the car, saw the passenger, pulled it right out of his dip, opened the door and took off running.
Charles Holden said the guy had one bag, Eskins said he had two, and both said the gun was out already. Philippou didn't mention any bags in her statement to Internal Affairs, but when prompted by prosecutor Lizette Ringgold-Kirksey, it all came flooding back.
When the person was running, were you able to see the handgun at that time?
Yes, the whole time he had it in his right hand.
Did you see any other items?
He, I think, was wearing a bag. He dropped something. We mentioned it. We went back and looked for it after the whole incident occurred. I think it was like a purple bag, maybe Ravens.
The state's exhibit number 9 look familiar to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Why? How so?
That's the bag that he dropped. I wanted to pick it up, but I had one hand on the radio and I didn't want to lose sight. So I left it there and I just made a mental note of where it was.
The second bag that Eskins mentioned was never recovered, but it was superfluous anyway. Much harder to evade the police in a foot chase when you're carrying two bags, a handgun, and, if you believe the state's case, a cell phone, since that's what Keith Davis Jr. had in his hands that morning. When Eskins left the crime scene after the shooting to find Charles Holden, the Ravens bag was lying exactly where he said the suspect had discarded it, and it was empty. Since Philippou's robbery suspect carried his gun in his dip, what was the bag for?
One of the oddest parts of the crime scene to me is the fact that Eskin manages to carry an entire folder of reports, a driver's license, a notebook, and a lease report in one of his hands while he's supposedly chasing a man armed with a gun.
If Eskin's testimony and crime scene photos are to be believed, both officers ran all the way to the garage on Eleanora Avenue with their hands full. They were, quote, piggybacking off each other on the police radio during the foot chase, and the crime tech photographed two small piles of paperwork in the street in front of the garage. You know what? Let's let Eskins explain. He's so good at it.
So you had the paperwork in your hand as you were chasing the defendant?
I did.
And do you recall if you had the paperwork in your hand at the time that you ran upon the garage?
I remember I had to, when the defendant entered the garage, that's when I started to, that's when the sense started to kick in that something was about, when someone goes into a place where you can't see them anymore, then you escalate your fear level a little bit. So that's when I dropped the paperwork and withdrew my weapon.
I mean, I've been in a lot of foot chases. I don't understand how you get such tunnel vision that you maintain possession of a folder full of reports while you're chasing a man armed with a gun. Now, running with our gun out, it's not something that's encouraged, but if you do run with your gun out, we're taught to keep our finger outside and below the trigger guard. So in case you fall or trip, you don't accidentally squeeze off around. I would think chasing a guy armed with a gun, one hand on your radio, you want to at least have your gun hand free of anything. I mean, it's like right. Muscle memory. And in fact, it's something that we're taught, like your dominant hand is supposed to be free. Like you're not supposed to carry things in your dominant hand because it's your gun hand. So if you need to retrieve your gun quickly, you're not holding keys or something like that in your hand. So I don't know how he's using the radio and carrying a folder full of reports for 3 or 4 blocks across Rice's Town Road and then gets involved in a shootout. What's also weird is, you know, at some point, someone puts a rock on top of the vehicle report so it doesn't blow away. And so it didn't blow away before that. It was all good up until somebody was like, oh, better put a rock on that because it's going to blow away.
To me, it looks weirdly staged. I'm not saying it was, but I'm thinking, well, if it was, what would be the purpose of putting that at the scene for some reason? I'm not sure.
In my opinion, the reports and stuff being left at the crime scene, and then his testimony is that he said he zoned out or he got tunnel vision, that he just ended up carrying these reports with him. I feel like that's like a cover or an excuse to be like, yeah, well, I couldn't have had my gun in my hand because I had a folder full of reports in my hand. I mean, look, all kinds of weird things happen. A lot of stuff goes through a cop's mind when they get in a stressful situation. So I can't say it didn't happen, but it just seems odd that as much as we're trained to keep our dominant hand free and to actually try to stay out of tunnel vision, that you would be chasing somebody armed with a gun with a handful of stuff.
Key to the defense's case was convincing the jury that Keith Davis Jr. was misidentified as the armed robbery suspect after officers Lane Eskins and Catherine Philippou lost the real culprit during the initial foot pursuit. In the first episode of this podcast, you heard Keith's testimony from his second trial in May 2017, where he described buying a pack of cigarettes from a corner store on Reisterstown Road and then lighting one up right next to the alley that runs behind West Belvedere. When he heard someone in the alley say, "He's got a gun," Keith took off running towards Eleonora Avenue via another alley directly across the street. So let's assume that Eskins and Philippou did at one point have eyes on the robbery suspect and were correct in following him down the alley behind West Belvedere. Then it's very likely that the suspect disappeared on Linden Heights Avenue, which runs parallel with St. Charles and Reisterstown Road, and a block and a half down leads directly to the Northwest District Police Station.
Get out of the district, turn to Linden Heights, which is the rear street for the district. I start going down to Belvedere. And then at that point, when I go on Linden Heights, I saw this black male with a hand on his right hand running towards Reisterstown Road. And then I hit the brakes because I know that Officer Eskin is coming behind him. He's going to let out the location where the guy is running. So I hit the brakes. Eskin came out the alley. He looked at me and he kept running behind this male. I decided to go straight down to Belvedere. On Belvedere, I make it right and stop on the corner of Reisterstown Road and Belvedere. And I started looking, and I saw the male still with the gun. He came out from the alley. I came crossing straight Reisterstown Road to the next alley, and Eskin's behind him. So I decided to turn the sirens on already got the lights on. I turned the sirens. I cross out Restertown Road, make it right to Eleanor, and just getting ready to get it, I hit out the alley. This male came out, still with a gun in the hands, and just crossed inside the building. But that time I didn't know that was a garage, that building.
And when you said you saw him chasing the defendant, who is him?
Officer Eskins.
We get to Linden Heights Avenue, the 5200 block of Linden Heights, and I heard a vehicle accelerate. I looked to my right, and I saw my sergeant traveling south on Linden Heights. He slowed down, let us go by. I was about the width of the street away from the defendant while I was chasing him.
In her trial testimony, Catherine Philippou said she was right on Eskin's heels and did not see Santiago nearly hit him on Linden Heights Avenue. In fact, she doesn't remember seeing Santiago en route at all.
And it's her testimony that you were immediately behind Officer Eskins, correct?
Yes, within 10 feet or less.
Did you observe Officer Sergeant Santiago nearly strike Officer Eskins on Linden Heights?
No.
Did you observe Officer Eskins on Linden Heights at all?
Like I said, we ran down the alley, so we weren't on the actual streets. Only street we were on was St. Charles until we hit the alley, and everything was alleyways the whole way down. So we crossed through a couple streets. Reisterstown Road was the main street that we actually crossed. Everything else was an alley until we got to Eleanor.
So when you approached Linden Heights by the alley, did Sergeant Santiago nearly strike Officer Eskins?
I'm not sure.
Did there come a point in time when you saw Sergeant Santiago's vehicle at all en route?
I remember seeing him pull up at the scene.
But just a month earlier, Philippou did remember seeing Santiago almost run down Eskins. Only they were on Reisterstown Road, not Linden Heights.
He ran about two alleys down, crossed over Reisterstown Road. I remember Sergeant Santiago coming down with the shift commander car because as we ran onto Reisterstown Road, he had to brake kind of hard to not hit Eskins.
Officer Diana Brown saw Santiago ahead of her on Reisterstown Road, as both of them had been at the Northwest District Station that morning when the call for backup came out over dispatch.
Sergeant Santiago was in front of me, meaning he wasn't directly in front of me. He was in front of me by Belvedere.
So he was ahead of you?
Ahead of me, yes.
And when he was ahead of you, he was ahead of you on Reisterstown Road, correct?
At Belvedere.
I'm sorry?
At Belvedere.
So is it your understanding that Sergeant Santiago drove on Reisterstown Road and made a right onto Belvedere?
I believed he drove on Reisterstown. I'm not sure where he drove to.
Did you see Sergeant Santiago's truck?
I saw his truck.
What truck was he driving?
He was driving the black SUV.
So when you were on Reisterstown Road, did you have a visual of, could you see that black SUV?
After I saw the suspect, yes.
And so, according to your testimony, you're driving on Reisterstown Road, you saw someone run across Reisterstown Road, and Sergeant Santiago had already passed that point, correct?
He had already passed that point. He wasn't directly ahead of the suspect when I saw him.
So is it your testimony that at the time you saw someone running across Reisterstown Road, Sergeant Santiago had already reached Belvedere?
Yes.
Okay. So Sergeant Santiago then made a right onto Belvedere, correct?
I don't know if he turned on Belvedere. Yeah, I saw him at Belvedere in Reisterstown is what I'm explaining.
So was there any point in time when you saw Sergeant Santiago on Linden Heights nearly striking Officer Eskins?
No.
So Sergeant Santiago was not driving on Linden Heights and had to slam on his brakes to avoid Officer Eskins?
Objection.
I didn't know that. I was never on Linden Heights.
Officer Brown, at any point in time, did you see Officer Eskins on Reisterstown Road?
No, I didn't.
Did you see any other officers while you were driving on Reisterstown Road?
I just saw the SUV at Belvedere.
Santiago says that he drove down Linden Heights Avenue and turned right on West Belvedere. When he got down to Reisterstown Road, he paused and looked to his right and saw the suspect pop out of the alley again, followed closely by Officer Eskins. What timing this guy has.
Can you describe him? Would you remember?
The only thing, it's been so much time, the blackmail, I don't remember that dark colored gun in his right hand. That's okay. What I recall.
So you saw a gun?
Yes.
As Keith Davis Jr. and his supporters continued to take in hours of contradictory testimony from the officers who shot him, outside the courtroom, Kelly had just received a special delivery.
I was subpoenaed to the grand jury by a homicide detective. Now they're using anything they can to come after Keith, and I believe to come after me. And it's not going to be tolerated, and it's not going to be taken lightly.
Next week on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Kelly Davis, Angela Bernico, Peggy Amaker Murphy, Megan Kenny, Zach Zweigel, Chris Cummo, Payam Sarabi, Baltimore Block, everyone on Team Keith for your dedicated coverage of Keith's trials. You gave me a running head start on this project, and I'm so grateful for your efforts. Baynard Woods, Brandon Soderberg, Brandon Weigel, and Anya Parampil, thank you for covering Keith's case these last 4 years and for doing so with integrity and an open mind. Thank you so much to Larry Smith Jr. Surprise, you're in another episode. If you don't like it, then stop saying such smart, insightful things. Thank you so much to Rabia, Susan, and Colin for supporting this series and for trusting me with your platform. I'm super humbled, and I'm also, like, incredibly exhausted. Thank you so much to executive producer Mizel Telhen and sound producer Rebecca Lavoy. You guys keep me sane or semi-sane, whatever I'm capable of on a given week. Thank you so much for your support and for all your hard work and for making this such a great show. I appreciate you both so much. Shout out to Erica, Dawn, Britta, and Skylar for transcribing every episode and for being such passionate fans of the podcast. It's awesome. You can find those transcripts on our website, undisclosed-podcast.com. Thank you to our sponsors for keeping the lights on. Of course, thank you so much to all of our listeners for tuning in every week. If you have any questions about the case, please tweet them at us at @undisclosedpod, or you can send them to me personally at @XOAmelia. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Our handle is @undisclosedpod. And don't forget to rate us on iTunes. Want to do something to help Keith? Here are two very, very easy ways. The first is to give Marilyn Mosby, Baltimore City State's attorney, a call at her office. The phone number is 443-984-6000. Give her a call, tell her to drop the charges and to free Keith Davis Jr. The second thing you can do is to help Keith come home debt-free. Visit Fundraiser, that's FUNDRAZER.com/FreeKeithDavisJr. 100% of the money received from this campaign goes to Keith and to Kelly Davis so they can keep on surviving. Defending yourself against bunk charges for 4 years costs a lot of money, folks, so every little bit would really, really help out. Most of all, please keep saying Keith Davis Jr.'s name. Please keep sharing Keith Davis Jr.'s story. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.